as such. It dawned on me that there's something extra radical. Somehow it's tied in with counter-revolution. Exactly how it's tied in is not too clear, but in some way or another, the theory of permanent revolution is tied in with counter-revolution. And they present the view that it was some kind of theory advanced by Trotsky in the early days of the Russian Revolution, which was very much opposed by Lenin, and that Lenin spent a great deal of time fighting this theory. That's pretty much the Stalinist conception of it. Now, a little later, I'll go into some more aspects of their view of this theory. Among the Social Democrats, another area of the radical movement, you'll find very little material on the permanent revolution or its theory. It's very little discussed among them. One reason that for that, of course, is that in social democratic circles, little attention is paid to theory. Theory rates very low among the social democrats. More basic reason for the lack of discussion on the theory of the permanent revolution among the social democrats is that they see no difference or very little difference between Lenin and Trotsky. They consider the views of the two as identical. And still worse, they consider the views of Lenin and Trotsky as being in essence the same as those of Stalinism. Or they will put it this way, that the foundations that were led by Lenin and Trotsky led inevitably and logically to Stalinism, and that therefore in essence Leninism or Trotskyism is the same as Stalinism. So you will find very little among them about the theory of the permanent revolution. Now in our own party, the Socialist Workers' Party, we find various levels of understanding of the theory of the permanent revolution. Among some of the comrades, those who are perhaps newer to the movement, it's a rather mysterious formula that's somewhat difficult to understand. Exactly what it consists of remains rather vague, and it's not too clear in their minds exactly what is meant by permanent revolution, this rather strange combination of words. Among other comrades, the theory of the permanent revolution remains vague, somewhat vague, and yet it seems to be a theory that's confirmed by everything that happens. Whether it happens in China or Cuba or Latin America, no matter where it happens, no matter what happens, confirms the theory of the permanent revolution. And so you will hear some comrades just casually tossing off, well, this confirms the theory of the permanent revolution. Exactly what the theory is and how it is confirmed remains somewhat vague. In opposition to this, there's another view which holds that the theory of the permanent revolution is a very exact prescription. Formula of great exactitude, which has been put in doubt by the Chinese Revolution and by the Cuban Revolution. It will be admitted among these comrades that in certain aspects the theory of the permanent revolution has been confirmed, but in other aspects it has been put very much in question by the events in those two countries. Now this is more or less the way the permanent revolution is viewed in our own party and in the leading sections of the radical movement in the United States. Now, in order to understand the theory, I think it's best to go back to the origin of it, right from its very beginnings, so that we see it as it arose. And then as it rose and led to conflicting views, we can much easier find the exact character of this theory, and I think understand it better. Now, above all, this is a theory that is based in experience. This is one of the things that must be especially noted about the theory of the permanent revolution. It originated in experience. It originated in the experience of the Russian Revolution of 1905. Now, this revolution was led by Trotsky. He was the leading figure in that revolution. And if you hear very little about the Russian Revolution of 1905 in the literature of the Communist Party today, it is only because they cannot write about it without talking about Trotsky's role. He was the leader of that revolution. He was supported by the Bolsheviks, and he worked in collaboration with the Bolsheviks. Lenin was abroad at the time, and the Bolshevik representative in St. Petersburg, now Petrograd, was Krasin.
press and represented the Bolsheviks, and he worked very closely with Trotsky. And the Bolshevik press printed material written by Trotsky, and they arrived at joint formulations, the Bolsheviks and Trotsky. But Trotsky, as the head of the St. Petersburg Soviets, was the leader of that revolution. And it was in the experience of that revolution, the things that he saw in that revolution as a leader, as a participant, as a fighter in that revolution, that he derived this theory. That's one side of the origin of this of the theory of the permanent revolution. The other side of it is that it has a long theoretical tradition. Actually, it goes back to a suggestion made by Karl Marx in 1850, which in turn was derived from the experience of the 1848-1850 revolutionary wave in Europe. That was a big revolutionary wave that occurred in Europe at that time, sweeping many countries. And it was from what Marx and Engels saw in that revolution that they derived the concept that a revolution which begins against feudalism or against feudalistic heritages, which is begun by the bourgeoisie, inevitably tends towards a socialist stage. That's putting it very, very briefly. Trotsky picked up this theory in 1904, 1905, and looked at it in the light of the experience of 1905, and from this derived his theory. So we can make this conclusion about the theory of the permanent revolution so far as that side of its origin is concerned. There's actually more experience speaking for the theory of the permanent revolution than for the basic theory of socialism on the main sequence. By the main sequence, I mean that first you have feudalism, then capitalism, and then socialism. That's the main sequence as worked out by Karl Marx in the light of his studies. So far, the main sequence has not been observed. That is, we have not seen a sequence where you reach the highest stage of capitalism and then socialism. That would occur in the United States or Great Britain or Germany or in one of the industrially advanced countries. We have not seen that yet. We have not had that experience. What we have had is the experience of backward countries moving towards socialism. And for that, the theory of that experience is contained in this permanent revolution. Let me pose that again, what the main sequence is. That first in the development of society, at a certain point, we reach feudalism. Feudalism prepares the basis for capitalism. Capitalism advances technology to such a high degree that it is impossible to go to socialism. So naturally, that would seem to occur along a straight sequence through the industrially advanced countries like it primarily would be Great Britain, Germany, and the United States. That leaves open the problem of countries which still remain at a feudalistic level in the world of today where you do have industrially advanced countries. And the question arises, what about those countries? What about countries that in the modern capitalist world still have feudalistic heritages or largely feudalistic? That was a question that the theory of the permanent revolution came to answer. I'm moving in just gradually here onto the theory itself, approaching it from various angles. Now in Russia, before 1905, there were various views about the Russian Revolution, the coming revolution, and primarily revolving around the problem that since Russia was under Tsarism and the main economy there was feudalistic in character, what about its role, what about its coming revolution? What would be the character of that revolution, and what would be the role of the Social Democrats, who at that time were the revolutionaries in Russia? Now, the first to take up this question were the populists. These were idealistic Democrats who believed in democracy per se, very idealistic about it. They saw the coming revolution in Russia as being democratic in character. In other words, it would sweep away Tsarism, would sweep away the feudalistic survivals in Russia, sweep away serfdom, which existed not only in the countryside, but also in the factories in Russia, sweep all those things away. And they saw as the main power in that revolution the peasantry, which constituted the overwhelming majority of the population in Tsarist Russia. And the populists, the idealistic Democrats, hoped that it would be possible in Russia to skip over the capitalist stage completely. In other words, in Russia, the peasantry would prove to be so revolutionary that by sweeping away czarism, they could jump right across capitalism and come directly to socialism. And they saw this as being possible through the existence of communes in Russia. In other words, there were many peasant communes in Russia, and they visualized the possibility that by the peasants taking power, they could directly convert these communes into some kind of a socialist system in Russia without going through the capitalist stage. That was the populist view. Now, this was the view that existed in the 80s, even earlier in Russia and through the 90s, and it was one that was met, first of all, by Plekhanov. And this was one of Plekhanov's great roles in the Russian Revolution, that is, in the theory of the Russian Revolution. He saw the coming revolution in Russia as bourgeois in character. Bourgeois in character because it would be powered by the peasantry and because its main tasks would be bourgeois in character. That is, it would have to sweep away feudalistic heritages, sweep away serfdom, give capitalism the possibility to develop quite freely in Russia. And consequently, he visualized this revolution as coming logically under the leadership of the bourgeoisie, since it would be a bourgeois revolution. Therefore, the leaders should be bourgeois. That's the logic of it. As for the working class, he visualized that as a component in this revolution, coming revolution. And he saw it, since the leadership would be under the bourgeoisie, he saw the workers as being in alliance with the bourgeoisie. And actually, he divided the bourgeoisie up into its various sections, the most reactionary section, middling section, and the liberal bourgeoisie. He gave the role of the leadership to the liberal bourgeoisie, and he saw the revolution as being consummated under their leadership in alliance with the working class. The outcome of the revolution he conceived as the establishment of a democratic republic, where there would be complete democracy in Russia, and that this would open up a big political arena where the working class would be completely free to organize its party, and to vie for leadership in the country. And eventually, as capitalism expanded and grew stronger in Russia, it would be possible in this arena where all different tendencies could clash, that the workers would gain so much strength that eventually there would be a clash between them and the bourgeoisie, and then the stage of the socialist revolution would open in Russia. In other words, Plekhanov held to the standard Marxist view of the main sequence: feudalism, capitalism, then socialism. And he held to the view which was held throughout the Marxist movement at that time, Western Europe and everywhere, that the socialist revolution would come first in the industrially advanced countries like Great Britain or Germany or the United States, and after it conquered in these countries, then it would sweep into the more backward countries, those who were industrially backward and on a much lower level. That was his view. And now we come to Lenin's view, which was somewhat different. And first on where Lenin agreed with Plekhanov, because there was a fundamental agreement with him in one respect at least. Lenin agreed that the coming revolution was bourgeois in character. And you can find any number of articles and references in Lenin where he describes the revolution, the coming revolution, this is before 1905, and even before 1917, that the coming revolution in Russia would be bourgeois in character. He saw its principal task as the solution of the agrarian problem, because that was the biggest problem in Russia, where the predominant population was a peasant, and where their main need was for land on which to work, on which to establish their farms, and to break up the old landlords' estates in Russia. That was the principal task, and this was closely associated with a national problem, because the peasantry was divided up into any number of different nationalities. In each nationality, there, of course, were a bourgeoisie of that particular nationality. So he saw these two problems in interrelationship, the agrarian problem and the national problem. From this, Lenin derived the view that the class of key importance in Russia was the peasantry. And that's one reason that when you read a lot of Lenin, you're amazed at the amount of attention he places on the peasantry. For example, some of Lenin's best studies on the peasantry deal with analyses of the actual class structure in Russia and its comparison with the class structure in other countries. One of his studies deals with the peasantry in the United States. And it's really amazing to read Lenin on what he says about the United States, about the peasantry in the South, their relationship to the farmers, all the different sectors of the American farmers and peasantry. He made that study of the United States in order to cast a new light on the problems in Russia. He was very much alive to this problem, and he placed it right up to the top of the agenda, which seems rather strange when you always think of Lenin as being a socialist. You know, why would he pay so much attention to the agrarian problem? And for the same reason, you have his studies on the national question, which was intimately linked with the agrarian problem, because he saw those as the key problems in Russia. They were the peasantry was the great power that would make the revolution and assure its success in Russia. Now, up to that point, there's no disagreement between Lenin and Plekhanov. They see eye to eye on this question. The coming revolution in Russia is bourgeois in character. But now Lenin has a difference with Plekhanov. The difference is that Plekhanov does not trust the bourgeois as leaders of the peasantry. He doesn't see it as being possible that the Russian bourgeoisie will actually lead the peasantry in this coming revolution. And the reason for that is that the bourgeoisie in Russia had any number of ties with the landlords, and their interests were closely associated with those of the landlords, and therefore it would be very difficult for them to break those ties and lead the peasantry into cleaning out the whole landlord system and serfdom in Russia, or vestiges of it remained. And consequently, he saw the role of leadership as falling to the workers in Russia, and that was something new. No one had had that view before, that the leadership of the revolution in Tsarist Russia would be the working class. And from this, we come to the main difference between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. So the Mensheviks followed Plekhanov's view that the leadership would naturally and logically fall with the bourgeoisie, and therefore, politically, it was necessary for the workers to make a close alliance with the bourgeoisie. On the other hand, the Bolsheviks under Lenin distrusted the bourgeoisie and said the main leadership is going to fall on the workers, and therefore the key question is to make an alliance between the workers and the peasantry. That's the key problem. And therefore, you have to study the interests of the peasantry, formulate them correctly, and lead them. But in order to lead them, you've got to have a party of the workers. So this was the theoretical basis for Lenin's extreme stress on the need for a working class party in Russia, because a tremendous task would fall on this party, not only of leading the workers, but through the workers of leading the peasantry. That was the basis of Lenin's view on the primary role of the party. Its organization of the party, of course, followed from the conditions in Tsarist Russia, where they had to work underground. Now, Lenin came to this view that once the government came to power in Russia, led by the workers and powered by the peasantry, that this government would be a democratic dictatorship of the workers and the peasants. That was his formula. And he repeated it year after year after year, right up until 1917. Now, this is a very interesting formula, democratic dictatorship of the workers and the peasants. That's quite wrong for us at this stage to simply dismiss it as being wrong, because it wasn't wrong. What it was a first approximation of what kind of government would come to power in Tsarist Russia. First approximation, and it was a very wide formula. As Trotsky described it, it was an algebraic formula, which would be filled in by the coming revolution. Now, Lenin deliberately made this a vague formula, democratic dictatorship of the workers and the peasants. He made it vague, and he left open completely how this formula would be filled in by the revolution. He visualized various possibilities. It could be possibly a peasant government, in which the peasants played the biggest role. Or it could turn out that at a certain stage that the peasants would recede, the workers wouldn't be quite able to retain leadership or hold leadership, and the bourgeoisie would take over, the liberal bourgeoisie. And he even left open another possibility, that the workers would retain leadership in this revolution, leading the peasantry in this government, which he visualized. He was extremely cautious about foreclosing the possibility of the peasantry in Russia actually playing an independent political role. He thought the peasants might have that capacity. And what's most important about this is to understand that when Lenin visualized the peasantry as playing an independent role, he visualized them as playing not a socialist role, but a petty bourgeois role. In other words, he excluded the peasantry completely, as did Plekhanov, Trotsky, all of them, of being a socialist or following a socialist policy. He visualized them as following an independent policy of their own in distinction and even in opposition to that of the working class. And he was very cautious about eliminating that possibility. He wanted to keep that open because he viewed the peasants as allies in the struggle against the big bourgeoisie, but not as socialists and not as socialist allies. The socialist allies of the Russian working class, he saw those in Western Europe, among the workers in Western Europe and elsewhere. Now, he called it this kind of government, which would come to power, a dictatorship, because he foresaw a desperate resistance on the part of the landlords to this government when it came into power. He saw desperate resistance by the capitalists and by the czarists. And since it would be not a socialist, he saw that it would not be a socialist government, but some other kind of a government, it would nevertheless have to exercise dictatorial measures against these elements who would resist the revolutionary upsurge, who would resist the measures that would have to be taken. And therefore, it would be a dictatorship, a governing regime which would exercise itself as a dictatorship against the landlords, the capitalists, and the czarists. Now, among the tasks that he foresaw for this democratic dictatorship would be, first of all, the solution of the agrarian problem. In other words, it would give land to the peasantry and end all the traces of serfdom and of czarism. It would solve the national problem by permitting any nationality that want to break away, if it wished, from Russia. Its essential task would be to widen the old bourgeois framework, make possible for capitalism to really get going in Russia. It would establish political democracy, which is one of the characteristics of the bourgeoisie. They're the great establishers of political democracy in the opening stages of the capitalist revolution. That's a long time ago, that's not today, but in the opening stages, in the main sequence, political democracy belongs to the bourgeoisie. And the Russian Revolution, he foresaw, would give a big impulse to the socialist revolution in the West, even though it was a bourgeois revolution in Russia. It would give a tremendous impulse to the socialist revolution in the West. And by doing that, it would open up big possibilities for, in the case of a victory in Western Europe and the establishment of socialism in the industrially advanced countries, it would open up big possibilities then for linking the Western Revolution in with the Russian Revolution and thereby bringing socialism into Russia. In brief, what he foresaw was the establishment of a bourgeois republic, the establishment of a free class of farmers, like we have in the United States. And he said that in so many words, that the establishment of farmers like the United States, and that in brief, what would happen in Russia if they had a successful revolution would be the establishment of the American pattern, not the German pattern where revolution there occurred under very contradictory circumstances with the reactionary Junkers taking power and opening up the possibilities for capitalism. So what Lenin was fighting for was the establishment of the American bourgeois system in Tsarist Russia. Strange as it may seem to us looking back, but that's what he was actually fighting for. In other words, he was fighting for the American model in the Russian Revolution in those days. All right, now when he's finished with Lenin, we come to Trotsky. Now, Trotsky's main disagreement with Lenin was not on this sequence. It was not on this overall view. You see, that's where the Stalinists distort it. They say that this was the main dispute between Lenin and Trotsky, but it was not. The main dispute between Lenin and Trotsky was on internal party politics. Now, just spend just a word or two on that. The social democracy in Tsarist Russia had split between a majority and a minority. And as you all know, minority is Menshevik and the majority is Bolshevik. Those are the Russian terms for those words. Now, trust that the split was not well understood in those days in the radical movement, either in Russia or in other countries, and many attempts were made to heal this split. Trotsky's main concern in the internal party politics of the social democracy in those days was to heal this split, and his formula for that was to make concessions to the Mensheviks, which Lenin vigorously objected to. And, but no one could quite understand why Lenin objected to this, because the leaders of the minority were very wonderful comrades with tremendous talents and great capacities. Trotsky had the theory that as the class struggle developed in Russia, this would automatically force both the majority and the minority to develop revolutionary policies at a certain stage, and this would bring them together. And he was just anticipating this bringing together by his policy of trying to conciliate the two sides, and especially that the Bolsheviks should make some concessions to the Mensheviks in order to fuse the party. And that was the main disagreement between Lenin and Trotsky, not the problem of the permanent revolution. It's very important to keep that in mind. Now, Trotsky's forecast of the revolution, he agreed with Plekhanov that it would be bourgeois, and was against the populists on that point. And he agreed with Lenin that the main sequence would be bourgeois and that the workers would lead this revolution in alliance with the peasantry, that the workers should have the leadership. So there was complete solidarity with them on this main view. His feeling was, however, that the algebraic formula of the democratic dictatorship of the workers and the peasants could be filled in, that it wasn't necessary to leave it so vague with so many different possibilities. Lenin left a lot of possibilities open. Trotsky said, we can fill in this formula, we can fill in the, and put in more exact terms exactly what's going to happen. We don't have to leave it so vague. And as a matter of fact, he said, if we leave it vague, we run into certain dangers when the revolution comes. There can be a misunderstanding of what's going to happen. There can be even disorientation as to what will happen. But we can fill it in. And if we fill it in as he saw it should be filled in, this would lead to some very unexpected consequences. And it's precisely because of these unexpected consequences that the Social Democrats should be prepared. And he meant by that both the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. He based himself primarily in the beginning on his experience in 1904 and the early part of 1905. In 1904, he saw that the liberal bourgeoisie were not leading. They had all kinds of petitions meetings calling for an end of czarism or for reforms and all that sort of thing, but they actually were not accomplishing very much. And they seemed to be getting into a blind alley. And still worse, the Social Democrats and those who followed them and who put hopes in the liberals were also landing in a blind alley. He saw that the peasant movement at that time in Russia was creating very favorable conditions for victory. There were movements all over Russia. It was quite clear that there was a developing revolutionary movement in Russia. But he also saw that the peasantry could not assure a victory, and that this could only be assured by an armed uprising of the working class, and that the first stage of this armed uprising would be a general strike. And that was his view at the beginning of 1905, and he wrote a pamphlet along those lines, stating what these conditions were, and forecasting the possibility and the necessity for the workers to take the leadership and to prepare for an insurrection against czarism. Now, his reasoning went along the following lines. I'll just indicate his reasoning here so as to bring out more clearly now the theory of the permanent revolution. The revolution in Tsarist Russia, he said, would be a bourgeois revolution. He's in agreement with Plekhanov and with Lenin on that. The agrarian reform is the main question in Tsarist Russia. But the bourgeoisie cannot lead this because of the existence of a powerful working class. In previous revolutions, in France, for example, it was possible for the bourgeoisie to lead a revolution because they had no fear of an alternative leadership or of opposition from a new class, such as the working class. But in Russia, a very powerful working class existed, and its mere inclusion in the revolutionary struggle would inevitably project it towards opposition with the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie could see this and therefore would be very, very hesitant about leading even its own revolution. In addition to that, they had very close ties with the landlords, which would prevent them from taking the necessary measures against the landlords in Russia. All right, now, besides, if the bourgeoisie are excluded from leadership, and the peasantry cannot lead it, as we'll come to in a minute, that leaves the city petty bourgeois. Is it possible for the city petty bourgeois to lead the bourgeois revolution in Tsarist Russia? Trotsky thought that it would not be possible because the city petty bourgeoisie would be torn in two directions, one direction toward the working class and the other direction toward the bourgeoisie. And the question was whether or not the peasantry could lead this revolution as a possibility which Lenin had left open. Trotsky thought that it was excluded. First of all, the peasantry were scattered over a tremendous country, the largest country in the world. Communications between them were very, very poor. In order to